In the first interview, we discussed Windswept House, the major theme of which was the apostasy, the ultimate source of which was Lucifer. And now I would like to discuss some of the characteristics of the New World Order that they're trying to put in place. What are the main characteristics of the New World Order that's coming into place towards the end of the 20th century?
Well, I'll tell you, Bernard, it's a very important question, because a lot of people, when they hear about the New World Order, say, oh, that means a new world government. There'll be one government that will govern everybody. And that's not the idea of the New World Order, number one. Number two, the New World Order, in its essence, is already here. It's established. We can't get out of it, whether you like it or not. Or whether you like it or whether you know it, it is here. What is it? It's this. That today, there is no country which cannot be divided into three parts. There's always the government, and it's more and more important than it ever was before. There's the business community. And then there's a group of things called NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Everything from mad mothers against drunk drivers over to the Catholic Church. That's where the church is today. That's where religion is. It's simply one of a mass of civil organizations that are competing in the public square.
So it's been demoted.
That's right. I mean, when something happens nowadays, they don't say, what does the church think? No, no, no. It's what scientists think, what business think, what government thinks. And also, if some priest wants to talk, or some minister or rabbi wants to talk, they will listen. But it's only... Now, that's the composition of the modern world. Every nation we know, even China itself, divides forces into that family. That's number one characteristic of the New World Order, that religion has become just one of the non-governmental organizations competing in the marketplace for popularity and for adherence. The second characteristic is this, that nowadays, no nation, and this is the chiefest effect of the New World Order, no nation can survive unless it shares in the globalized money. What does that mean? It means that the daily flow of capital and the flow of capital goods is regulated by global rules. And if you don't share in that, you perish. For instance, what happened in North Korea? Do you remember, 5-6 years ago, they were threatening to lob missiles at us. Now what they're doing, they're knocking at the door. They're hungry, because they don't belong to international trade. They're just beginning to realize that they can't sell or buy anywhere. And they're starving, by the way. The South Korea is now giving food to North Korea.
Now, this is a change, because we can remember in the 1930s how Stalin built his socialism in one country.
Sure.
That doesn't seem to be the... program today, because like even the Chinese communists have integrated themselves into the world economy.
And they're trading and buying and selling to billions, to the tune of billions on both sides. At first, I think Albania. Albania said, no, we're communist. Now they're in complete chaos, because they tried to stay outside. Now they're no longer outside, they're nowhere, they're in chaos.
Now,
So the point I'm making is that no country can live, can subsist today, unless it belongs to the global rules. And one of the global rules is that the flow of capital and the flow of capital goods produced by capital, you must participate in that, or else, buddy, you are for the grave.
Now, does that mean that communism is dead? Let's say like that in China, they now have elements of market economy?
Communism is dead. Marxism is not, as a method of thought. Marxism is not, as a method of thought.
So Marxism is more than just a command-style economy.
It's an ideology. It's an ideology. And it's basically this. Its main tenets are so simple. Man is an animal, a highly organized animal, period. Nothing more, number one. Number two, there's only this life. There's only matter. Smells, sounds, sights, dimensions. That's all there is. And thirdly, the state is finally the most powerful organ, and that's what's happened. The government in every country is far more important than it ever was before. And in this country, the same thing. And we can't get rid of the government any longer.
So the central organizing principle, let's say, of Marxism never was centrally controlled economy. Yeah. It was this worldly mentality.
That's right. That's what Marx was building up.
And so, let's say, Chinese communism has undergone, let's say, a metamorphosis.
Sure it has. And they now have one whole area which is totally capitalistic. And, for instance, there are Chinese returning and building houses in Shanghai. They're millionaires. There's no difficulty. The Chinese are very practical. And just it's to make money. Now, what they do maintain is government control of the masses, because then they have cheap labor. They have cheap labor. And they can kill as many babies as they want to and keep the population down. It's already 1 billion point something. So they can do all that. But that's Marxism, not communism. Communism is a joke. Nobody ever prospered under communism. The Soviet Union collapsed, imploded because of communism. And it's created havoc in all these countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, and East Germany. They were in ruins, and Poland, at the end of their communist life.
But here's a question I have. If, let's say, the what is officially the Communist Party of China has adopted a market economy,
sure.
And we in the West have adopted a this worldly view and implemented, let's say, a liberal abortion policy.
Yes, yes.
What difference is there between us and them?
None. None, except we have more liberal laws and we have a system of justice which is more liberal, certainly as regards the criminal.
But these are differences of degree, not of kind.
No difference in kind. I'm sorry. Now, we have more tolerance here, less and less, by the way, for churches, for religions. We have less and less.
So there is, let's say, a capital that has been built up over the Christian centuries that we're now living off, and this still has, let's say, a positive influence in countries like America and Canada and Great Britain.
A little, only a little. What you're really saying, Bernard, if you think, you're saying there's convergence.
Yes.
We're converging finally to the same system. And by the way, George Shultz went with, Ronnie Reagan to Moscow in the 1980s, and they wrote down, they composed the famous Cultural Agreement, which means that what they're laboring now in Moscow and in New York, the Carnegie Endowment for the humanities here, and then a thing called Informatic in Moscow, they are producing the same textbooks for children in Russia, as here, as in Borneo, as in Latin America, as everywhere, only the language will be different. So children will learn the same things everywhere, and there'll be homogeneity.
Now, this is a point I want to stop at right here, because it seems like the globalists, what they want to do is to level or snuff out kind of the local particularisms of any kind.
That's right. That's right. And you see, here's the terrible thing for Americans when they realize it, which is not yet, there will come a time, shortly, when laws affecting their salaries, the place they live, their housing, their taxes, their travels, their family, will be made by non-Americans.
Isn't this actually the issue that got Margaret Thatcher so furious towards the end of her rule as prime minister, the fact that more and more British sovereignty was passing into the hands of the European Union.
Was being eroded and passed on with the European Union. That's what now makes the big opposition in Britain. They know that when they enter the European Union, when they have monetary union in 1999, that is the end of Britain as they know it. So much so, Bernard, I think there are going to be big resistance to this European Union at the last moment. They may have to enter it, and they may go under, be submerged, and it'll be the end of England as we have known it. But to revert to the situation with the New World Order, Americans will find this out too late, and they can't do anything about it. What can we do? when the laws are made by others. And for instance, the new the NAFTA agreement affects jobs here. Can we do anything about it? No, sir. And the World Trade Organization, of which we're signatories, are going to make laws about world trade that will affect our jobs and our money and our dollar and our salaries. We can't do anything about it. We are caught in it. There's no escaping this. We're in the new world order. Now, here's the point. Remember we spoke about the advances in the medical field, the health field, and the development of abortion and contraception as a means of accustoming people to another way of looking at the human body and the development of the human frame, and finally the goal of having the subhuman culture. That's all part of the same system. Create a paradise on earth for the elite. Period.
Now, the argument has been that what we would have is a global economy, but that culture would be decided locally. But when I, let's say, pick up the papers and read, let's say, about your home country of Ireland,
right,
it seems like the same pressure is causing the Irish culture to break down. They now are passing laws opening up abortion and divorce.
Absolutely. And it's that. And the culture is, the ancient culture, the Christian culture, is being eroded. There's no doubt about that. It's being eroded. For instance, there's a thing called river dance. I don't know if you've seen it. It's the Irish dance. And it's the first time the Irish have produced something which has no religious aspect. It's based on myth, and it's based on pagan myth, and it's based on pagan belief. But if you haven't come across it, it's something else. So the culture is being eroded and replaced with this new culture.
But doesn't this new culture kind of create what you had very much in the Soviet Union, kind of a drabness?
Of course it does. Of course it does. And people are getting bored with it. There are more suicides, and people are revolting against it. But we can't do anything about it, Bernard. Whether we like it or not, we're walking into it. And we're going to be subjected to the same godless, sometimes pornographic, television and amusements. There'd be no mention of God. There'd be no mention of eternal life. There's no mention of religion. That's the transcendent view that's excluded from the public square in America, according to the Supreme Court. And that's the new world order. Now, what's going to happen? Well, is it going to go hunky-dory like that? And will we finally find ourselves faced with the faceless state government making laws that we can't disobey and that confine us and really erode our religion? No, it won't go like that. It will not go through, because we have a solemn promise that God so loved this world that he sent his only begotten Son in order to save it. And we have also the promises of Our Lady and several big occasions at La Salette in France in 1846, because we're an old religion, and at Fatima in 1917, and at Garabandal in 1963. Those three alone tell us that God is going to step in and chastise this world and punish it for killing 500 million babies a year, and for oppressing and for shedding of blood and for starving people and inciting wars and finally destroying the innocence of youth with pornography. God's going to step in, and step in soon. And nobody that I know of any stature at all in the church today or in religion thinks it's going to come into 100 years' time. It's around the corner. It's coming fast.
Now, is this why, and you talked about this, I think that was the very first scene in Windswept House, mm-hmm, in 1957, when the dignitaries of six first countries of the, at that time it was the European Economic Community,
yeah,
met with the Pope, that the Pope, Pius XII, foresaw that they would have their day, but it would only be a day.
It's only a day. It's only a day, because God is in his heaven. And Bernard, I hate making predictions, because human predictions are so fallible. But, and I may not live, I'm 76, I may not live long enough to see this, But I know that within a short time, you, a young man, will see the hand of God punishing the world around you, and you included, because you're part of the world, and your family too.
Now, here is an issue that I would like to raise, and that's that there seems like, and you've alluded to this already in our conversations, that there is no escape. There's no place in the world that I can, let's say, move to and escape all the problems.
You can now, there are several communities, one in Idaho, one in Kansas City, St. Joseph's, Kansas, and in various other places, and in Canada, there are a few mentioned to me now and again in conversations. But they won't save you. They won't save anybody.
So it's not possible to entirely freeze out the world.
No. If you go down to the Pampas in Argentina, if you travel to the Gobi Desert, if you go anywhere, it's going to come after you, because the whole world is entrailed in it. And then, as far as we know, the best judgment is that the chastisement is going to affect everybody, whether you live in the middle of the Gobi Desert, or in Kathmandu, Nepal, or on the Pampas of Argentina, or hide beneath the ocean in a bubble, it will still get to you.
Now, isn't there an unfairness here? Because, let's say, many families and good priests have done their best and led virtuous lives, and yet they're going to suffer from this that was caused, the immorality of other people.
Sure, but remember when Christ was on his way to Calvary and the women were crying over him, crying over his pains and his torture. He said, don't cry for me, because I'm just the green wood. You're the dry. Cry for yourselves and your children. There's a law there which is funny. For instance, if you and I get married, and if you are a lush, a woman who's a drunk, and I'm a cocaine addict, and you conceive, the baby is going to be alcoholic probably, and is going to have AIDS, if I have AIDS, or one of us have AIDS. Why doesn't God save the baby? Punish us, but why does he doesn't save the baby? And if when Adam and Eve ate that apple or whatever they ate, why does he punish me? I didn't eat the apple. He has this law. And as the Bible says, the fathers ate sour grapes, but the children's teeth are blunt. In other words, the children are punished for what the fathers did. And that's God's law.
So God's law, and this is a theme too that emerged from Windswept House, is that there is salvation through suffering.
That's right. That's right. There's salvation through suffering, but there will be suffering caused by the sins of others. And the typical example is the baby who was aborted by its mother or its father. Well, it did nothing to merit such awful torture. But yet it's punished. Why does God allow it? Why doesn't he punish the parents? He doesn't. It's the baby. He punishes the parents later. But the baby suffers the dire pains of having an evil father and an evil mother. Similarly, war. I mean, there must be a lot of people killed in the last war, in the Second World War, that had no doing with it, and they had nothing to do with it at all. That's God's law. And it started with Adam and Eve. And by the way, we can all have a conversation with Adam and Eve later on. By the way, the church never called them Saint Adam or Saint Eve. Have you ever noticed that? Churches say Saint Abraham is a saint, and David is a saint, and Isaiah is a saint, and Jeremiah is a saint, but Adam and Eve are never described as saints. Ever. Because I think we have a crow to pluck with them, or a bone to pick with them. Because they did let us down. And because they did what they did, you and I are in our present quandary today, the possibility of going to hell. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for them. So don't grumble at me, it's unfair. Of course it's unfair, but you see, when you get to that region of unfairness, we have no rights. God is God.
And maybe he's trying to tell us that to build an earthly paradise just isn't possible.
He never destined it. He never wanted it. And Christ himself said to the apostles in that Last Supper, he said, but now it's the hour of the prince of this world and the hours of the powers of darkness, but he has nothing on me. He has no power over me. It's totally independent of the world and of the prince of this world. And that's why it's grieving. It's very grievous. And it grieves me an awful lot to find people talking about building a paradise and building a habitat for men and women and establishing universal fraternity and brotherhood. That's fine and dandy if you want to do that politically, but that's not the work of salvation. The work of salvation is You're in mortal sin, I'm going to forgive your sins. You're dying, I'm going to shroud you so that you go straight to heaven. That's what I can promise you. Nothing else. Nothing else.
So the problems in this life that, let's say, might flow out of this New World Order is just crosses, again, that good Catholics have to bear.
That's right. That's right. And be the butt, because we are the enemies. We're the only enemies. Because if they get rid of us, if they got rid of the Catholic Church, which they won't, then all other religions would collapse. There'd be no reason. Nobody would subsist. No Christian religion would start, but it would continue, and no Judaism would succeed. It would be all over. And the sacrament of the Mass would stop. There would no longer be a blessed sacrament, no chapel, no worship, and the eternal sacrifice the prophet Malachi speaks about would have ceased, and the world would come to an end. So we are essential, and Lucifer knows that. And he knows, too, he's going to be beaten, but he's doing his damnedest, as they say, to take as many with him, because he doesn't take prisoners.
Now, the focus of Windswept House was the Holy Father.
That's right.
Is that one of the key elements of this Luciferian movement of building the New World Order, is to gain some measure of control over the papacy?
Bernard, correct that statement, to gain total control. Total control. Because if you don't have total control over the papacy, just partial control of part of the papal government, the other part is going to go against you. You must control it completely. And there are two ways of control. Either I control it because I give you direct orders and you fulfill them, or I make it in such a way that you fulfill my will, my commands, without knowing it.
And that's perhaps the situation, the second scenario is perhaps the situation then that we have today.
For the majority. They think they're okay. They think it's fine. But some of them have lost the faith. Others are weak. And they don't want to go against the grain. They don't want to stand up and be counted. They don't want to rock the boat. I know, middle of the road, Monsignore and bishops, good priests who never soil their soul, never anything, never commit sins really, are just and good, but they won't do anything. They'll go along with anything that's proposed. And that I think, is as bad as the person who fulfills the evil commands of Lucifer. I think it's just as bad, you're permitting things to happen.
These are the lukewarm souls we're talking about here.
Yes, and the first curse in the apocalypse is, because you're neither hot nor cold, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. That's the first condition of the church.
And that's why we're called to be a church militant.
That's right. That's right. But tell me, where is that militancy today? Where is there any evangelistic fervor? Where is there a missionary effort? Where is there apostolicity and fervor and let's go do it, let's get moved? It doesn't exist. Where? Tell me, Bernard, do you see it anywhere? It's nowhere. That spirit has died out. It's now a question of compromise. And, for instance, the present Pope has signed an agreement with the Orthodox churches that he will forbid all proselytism. You can't try to convert a Russian or a Greek now. You're forbidden by the Pope. Come on. Now you're not supposed to try and convert Jews. That's also being frowned upon, because that offends our Jewish brothers. And their covenant is as valid as our covenant with God. So the doctrine goes. And that's the end of the missionary church. But, our condition is such that we need to have missions to ourselves, because we are fading fast in our ordinary liturgy, our ordinary prayer, our ordinary asceticism. And while there's a small handful getting better and better, getting more and more holy, getting more and more divine in their behavior, the majority of Catholics are being led out of the church by the nose, and they don't know it. They don't know it. They think it's okay. And as a priest, I meet them every day of the week in America. And they think everything is fine until you start pointing out certain things. And they suddenly say, yeah, that's funny. That's no good. And then you hope that it's only a conversation of 5 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour. You hope that later on it will bear fruit. But most of them find it's too difficult to go against the grain. How can they go up to their pastor and say, you're teaching heresy, or you're not teaching the truth? They're not going to do that. The pastor will say, you're an ignoramus. I did my theology. I'm a priest. I have authority from the bishop and the pope.
Well, I've known many laity who have gone, let's say, to the bishop, to the priest, and pointed out errors, and it does nothing.
No.
So they end up just walking out of the parish.
The terrible thing, Bernard, is this, that today it's not an isolated case. This is universal. This is universal. There's a universal laxity. There's a universally practiced permissiveness about sexual morality in your children. What mother is going to expel her son because he brings home his girlfriend to go to bed with him, or vice versa, a daughter bring back a boyfriend? No, they won't fight it. They're all over the place. And they're good people. They wouldn't do it themselves, but they won't correct the children because they're afraid of losing the children. And similarly with all other practices. So there's a general permission. And the priest says, well, you've got to help them along. They're young. And he doesn't enforce the rule. He doesn't preach against abortion. When is the last time you heard a sermon against abortion or against contraception or against homosexuality? You don't hear them nowadays. Because it isn't fair. It isn't democratic.
Now, isn't that a theme, too, of Windswept House? Is just there kind of is an atmosphere now of weakness and acquiescence?
That's right. Just weakness and acquiescence. And that's considered to be noble. It's considered to be American. It's considered to be democratic. It's considered to be good, to be normal, and not to be crabby and confined and prejudiced and be judgmental. You're not judgmental at all. You're not supposed to be judgmental. You don't judge anybody. That is the attitude today, and that's the new world order for you. That's the attitude of the new world order. And the laws help that.
Now, a subject that I'd like to move to next is this pope, because it's in Windswept House, it was the plot revolves around the resignation protocol. Why is it that some of the cardinals wanted to push the pope out? And is this actually the case in reality?
Well, here's the point. This pope is a Pole. And while he is very permissive in certain things, ecumenism, for instance, he is absolutely against any let-up of the church ban on abortion, contraception, masturbation, divorce and remarriage. He won't touch those things. No let-up at all.
So he is a barrier against implementing this new moral order.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, several authorities, including cardinals, have said that we have to change our laws about abortion, contraception, and divorce and remarriage. We must experiment. Further, they want to experiment with women priests. And this pope says no. And they want to experiment with married priests. And this pope says no. Not in the Latin Rite part of the church, anyway. Not in the Western part of the church. For other parts, yes. On the other hand, the Luciferians have a very tight schedule. They have an inner Luciferian prophecy that says that unless the prince is properly installed in the citadel, namely the Church, the Vatican, by 1999, they've lost. But in order to install him completely, to complete the enthronement, they have to get rid of this pope. Now, how do you get rid of a pope? Well, you kill him, or you get him to resign, or he dies. Now, they're not going to kill him, because it's too mucky, and then there's no such thing as a secret. We now know who killed the other popes, and we know why they did it. There's no such thing as a secret. It always leaks out. And they don't want this to be on
their own. Want it to backfire on them.
That's right, and it would. Is he dying? Well, that's a question I'll touch on in a moment. But the easiest thing is to persuade him to resign. He's 75. All bishops, and he's a bishop, resign their sees, their dioceses, at 75. So they kept at him in the 3 years prior to his becoming 75. He became 75 2 years ago. He's now 76. And they circulated a paper about him and about resignation. And he read it. He deals with them directly. And he wrote back comments in the margin about the rules of this. It was a paper which said, look, under these circumstances, the Pope should resign or be resigned. That was what the paper said. He wrote back and modified certain things. And finally, he decided to get out of the whole difficulty by writing his own document about papal resignation. And he did. He composed a motu proprio. Now, a motu proprio is the Latin-Roman term for what we call an executive order. When the president issues an executive order, nobody can disobey it. Every organ of government must obey it.
Talking about how the modernists in the Vatican want to push Pope John Paul II into resignation because they feel that his strong stand on moral values such as abortion and artificial contraception is blocking the coming of this new order that they're so much in favor of. And at the same time, you have a situation where many traditional Catholics are very disappointed in this Pope for reasons of his, let's say, as you've mentioned, ecumenism, lack of governance. This is a very, for many people, confusing and contradictory situation. And in the book, Windswept House, there were many discussions, let's say, between Father Gladstone and Father Slattery, and Father Gladstone and Father Carnesecca. Are these kind of discussions what are going on in the minds of many Catholics?
Yes. Most of those conversations, most of them, not all of them, most of the conversations are recorded ones I've had or listened into with my friends, priests in Rome when I went there, and priests here, and priests in France, and in England. These are the subjects that came up always. They were always discussed, sometimes virulently, sometimes angrily. People were either for or against. There are conversations that take place, that took place in my presence.
So between people and also sometimes maybe within the minds of one individual, I have a hard time sometimes making out this point.
Yeah, well, mostly they were based, in fact, I think every conversation there is based on conversation I listened to. I was privy to, I was
personal. Yes, and I've certainly encountered these kinds of conversations many, many times, because it seems that the point that's causing Catholics the most difficulty now is that of this Holy Father.
It is. It is the big stumbling block. And people fall into two or three categories. They either say, well, he's Holy Father. We don't understand why he does this. We think that that he's doing his best, and we'll understand later. Others say, no, he's wrong. He ceased to be Pope. We no longer owe him allegiance. And others say, it doesn't matter. He's Pope, and that's all that counts. So between the two of them, it's very hard to... Between the three of them, it's very hard to know what to do. Bernard, in this matter of the Holy Father, there's no doubt about it. There are things that we find very hard to understand or even to reconcile with Catholic faith. There are very hard things to reconcile. What is my attitude? My attitude is this. I'm not allowed to judge my Pope. Canon law forbids anybody to judge the Pope. Someday, the Church will infallibly pronounce a judgment on every Pope, especially on this Pope, because he's a key Pope. He's at a key moment in Church history. He has a key power to wield. He's wielding it in one direction, which I think is wrong, but I'm only a single Catholic and he's Pope. And I am not in the catbird seat. I don't know what he knows that makes him act as he does. I pray for him, and I will continue to honor him and defend him as my Pope. I will not agree with him when he teaches me something that goes against what I've been taught.
And a Catholic need not follow something that, let's say, goes against the faith, let's say, like, or the traditions of the Church, let's say, like his ecumenism.
No need whatever. In fact, you shouldn't. St. Thomas and all the saints say, if a bishop or a pope teaches something which you know from your tradition, from your teaching, from your catechism, from your parents, from your school, from your church, is not what the church has taught, you have no reason to follow it. You can say, no, Holy Father, I won't accept that, and still be a loyal Catholic. In fact, you are bound to do that for the sake of truth. You're bound to. The idea that when a pope says something, that says you can't open your mouth, that's not Catholicism at all. So that's my attitude to John Paul II. I have severe difficulties with a lot he has done and a lot he does. I have severe difficulties with a lot of things he says he believes. I can't believe them because my tradition in the Catholic Church says, no, that's not correct. For instance, my tradition tells me that Christ descended into the underworld to leave the souls in limbo. He denies that. I have to follow that creed. It's a part of the creed. He descended into hell. In Inferos. That's the old Latin is. It means hell or means the underworld. I can't accept that from him. He says that Martin Luther was a very good man, a great, profound religious thinker. I can't accept that. I think he was a pig and he was a blasphemer and I think he's in hell. Frankly, I just can't accept those things. But that doesn't mean the Pope is wrong or is bad or ceases to be Pope. It means I can't accept it and I'm not bound to accept it. So can't one be reasonably different from the Pope and yet be a good Catholic? Of course one can.
Now, a lot of people, too, have difficulty understanding just what is his strategy. And I think you've mentioned in the past that for the first 10 years or so of his pontificate, wasn't it directed towards a geopolitical strategy of bringing down the Iron Curtain?
Yes, it was. Up to 1981, he was persuaded that he had a long reign in front of him and that solution of problems was at a long, long range. Then he was shot. And as you know, when he lay in Gemelli Hospital in Rome, he had a vision. He had the Fatima vision. He saw it. God revealed it to him. He saw the whole thing. And he suddenly sent for his personal secretary and got the copy of The Secret, which he hadn't studied, and read it. And then he called a famous nun, a very well-known nun, who was an expert on Fatima, and sent her to Portugal to talk with Sister Lucia. And when he came out, it was quite obvious that he had another geopolitical purpose in mind. He now knew that he wasn't going to live for a long time in his papacy. It wouldn't last a long time. He also knew that Russia was finished, the Soviet Union was finished, but the Russia wasn't. And he set out, therefore, to exercise as much geopolitical influence as he could. But, you see, there was a flaw in his armor. And the flaw was this. He had won through a thing called solidarity. Do you remember the Solidarity organization?
Yes, that was headed by Lech Walesa.
Lech Walesa. Solidarność. The difficulty is this. The Solidarność was a purely secular movement. Purely secular. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's purely secular. Nothing religious. And he cut his teeth on that organization. That's how they defeated the Stalinists in Poland. That's how they brought Edmund Gierek, the premier, down with the whole government. They were on their knees to him and Cardinal Wyszynski for help, keep the country safe from the Russians, from the Soviets. When he then started his geopolitics, he still relied on secular organization. He wasn't acting merely and simply through faith, the arms of faith. No, he was doing politics, and it was the geopolitics of reason, not the geopolitics of faith. And by 1989-90, he had become totally immersed in geopolitics of reason. And he was a great friend of Gorbachev's, and he had become very close to the Americans, and he relied on secular movements to bring about spiritual ends. And it didn't happen. It only got worse.
So they did succeed in bringing down the Iron Curtain.
No doubt about it.
But it didn't have the fruits that he had, spiritual fruits that he had hoped for.
No, it hadn't. Because you see, he made a mistake, the same mistake as Paul VI made, and same as John XXIII made. And Bernard, I have asked myself again and again, why the three popes made this mistake? The Queen of Heaven gave a mandate. She said, consecrate Russia to me on one day, all you bishops together, and Russia will be converted to Catholicism. I mean, it wasn't really converted, it would become Catholic, and Marxism would be finished. And there'd be no chastisements. If you don't do that, my son is going to punish you all. And John XXIII and Paul VI and John Paul II, all three neglected this. John the 23rd said, the children didn't know what they were saying. They thought Russia was a whore in the streets of Lisbon. And anyway, I'm talking with Nikita Khrushchev. This was 1962. He will allow observers to come to my Vatican Council if I don't condemn Marxism. And therefore, John Luther didn't allow the fathers of the Council to condemn Marxism. And he certainly would not publish we will not publish this letter ever. It will never be published. And I will not consecrate Russia. Because if I did that, Nikita Khrushchev would know, and he'd consider it an act of war. All the bishops, Catholic bishops, gather in a place, 2,700 of them in the Vatican, and they condemn Russian Marxism, Soviet Marxism. Come on, it's war. There's going to be persecution. That's John XXIII's reason. Paul VI simply was afraid of his own shadow, and besides, he didn't believe in Fatima. John Paul II sort of believed in Fatima, sort of. He didn't quite believe in Fatima. And he decided that he couldn't do it because he wasn't the Pope of 1960. And Lucy had originally said the Pope of 1960 must do the consecration. So he did nothing about it. In fact, he permitted the suppression of Sister Lucia and permitted the suppression of the message of Fatima to a large extent throughout the church, because his Secretary of State, Casaroli, who is an atheist as far as I'm concerned, he exercised himself as Secretary of State through all Vatican representatives to suppress Fatima as much as possible. For instance, the apostolic delegate in Lisbon and his entire staff were very favorable to Fatima. Casaroli changed them all and put in somebody who was not sympathetic. And so on and went on. So why is it that these three popes, the last three popes, refused? And when John Paul II was asked to now consecrate Russia, no, all he could do was kneel in St. Peter's Square, and in the middle of a consecration of the human race, the Immaculate Heart of Mary, he said, and also we consecrate to her care the people who are awaiting their consecration to her Immaculate Heart. What sort of gobbledygook is that? For me, that's gobbledygook and disgusts me on John Paul II's lips. He's supposedly a knight of the Immaculate Queen. He's supposedly a member of Maximilian Kolbe's group of knights fighting, and he wouldn't do this. So, I mean, I think it all goes back to Lucifer. He just has too much power within the prelacy of the church, within the organization. He's able to squeeze everybody who attempts something.
And so Lucifer has paralyzed whatever efforts there have been, let's say, to do what the Mother of God actually wanted.
Yeah, this is the Queen of Heaven. And even if John 23rd said Nikita Khrushchev will declare war on us, he can say, well, you want this done, you must have some plan. Trust. No trust. So I think it is clear to me that the will of Christ is that these three popes should destroy the organization of the church, which they have. They've destroyed the organization. They've been instrumental. And they will answer for it. And in the case of John Paul II and John 23rd and Paul VI, it's malfeasance in high office. They're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to take care of that. They didn't.
So to get back then to the original question, the reason why John Paul II's geopolitical strategy ultimately failed to bring, let's say, the spiritual fruits that he would have wanted is because he used the methods that weren't prescribed by Our Lady.
That's right. That's why he was relying on purely spiritual means. Purely spiritual means. And therefore, and he didn't do what she said. She said, consecrate Russia to my Immaculate Heart, all you bishops, on the same day, using the same formula if possible. Do it. And publish this secret to the world. Publish the secret. No, no. No, we won't publish the secret ever, they say now. And Jean Paul II said from the beginning, we will not publish it.
Now, since the fall of the Iron Curtain, has Pope John Paul II actually had a coherent strategy for dealing, let's say, with the problems in the church and in the world?
No, he has not had a coherent strategy because, you see, we always forget this, Bernard. He is the head of a bureaucracy, a very talented bureaucracy. And its biggest source of talent is the Secretary of State. Now, the Secretary of State is divided into two sections. One deals with bishops. And the second one, the second part of it, deals with secular governments. By the way, they're experts. There's no doubt about the Vatican people know what they're doing. And their information is legendary. They have information on a 24-hour basis. They have a source of information that the American government or the CIA or the Mossad or the KGB haven't got. But they must implement a Pope's policy, and they are dead set against Pope John Paul II's geopolitics. They don't agree with him. They frustrated him, and they frustrate him. And now it's too late. They frustrated him because they have their own ambitions. Why? Because they're thoroughly penetrated with masonry.
So there are masons right in the Vatican.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's the difficulty. That's the big difficulty. We've been penetrated. The barbarians are in the streets of the city. They're not outside the door. They're not outside the walls. They're in charge. They're in charge. And John Paul II has realized that, that he can't move hand or foot unless he was strong enough to take out an axe and cut off heads. But he can't lift an axe any longer. He can't cut off any heads. He is dying. This is July. This is March 22. Our Pope, John Paul II, is dying on his feet. For sure he's dying. It's not the dying that I'm 76, and I suppose in a certain sense my body is dying because it ceased to grow. But I'm not dying in the sense he is actually dying. You can measure week by week his weakness, the way he shuffles, the way he grunts instead of talking, the way he can't shake hands, he can't look at you in the eye, he can't bend. He shuffles along the ground, he doesn't walk. He slumps into a chair, he doesn't sit down and stand up. He's helped out of a chair and he slumps back into it. He's dying, literally. And we know it. Everybody knows it, but the Vatican has covered it all up. Has he got Parkinson's disease? Has he got Parkinson's disease? It's like saying, have I got a bloodstream? He has that for a long time. So he's dying, and he can't do anything about it. And now he has all the ghosts of the past coming at him. And he's all the ghosts of the present moment. And all the specters of unsolved problems. And his judgment is gone awry. I mean, he receives Fidel Castro and Gorbachev in the same 36 hours. And honors them. You don't honor people of that nature. If you have to talk to them, you talk to them very privately. And you send it through a Monsignore or a bishop, of which he has many. You don't honor them with a papal visit.
Now, you've just mentioned Gorbachev, and the book Windswept House spoke a lot about Russia. Mm-hmm. Does Russia still play an important role in the message of Fatima, even though the Iron Curtain has come down?
It does. It does. And I said to you, and I think it's true, that there's some unfinished chapter or paragraph in John Paul II's life before he dies in connection with Russia. His destiny is tied with Kiev in Ukraine and with Moscow. Why, I don't know, but I know this much. That's what he has told me, and I believe it. There's something connected there. Now, as regards the message of Fatima, it still stands. It still stands. The errors of Russia are now abroad, and they are abroad. Russia will be converted, finally, by my immaculate heart, she said. It will be, she said it. But a bit late, but not too late, she said. So Russia is within the plans. Why? That would take me too far afield into papal secrets. Why Russia and Kiev are involved in the final solution of this problem. But they are. They're part and parcel. And it's really God's choice. It's purely and simply God's choice, like he chose the Jews to bring his son into the world through them. He makes choices. He has his own favorite solutions for things. I wouldn't have chosen the Russians or Kiev or the East for salvation, but salvation is to come from the East for us all. And John Paul II is inevitably tied into it. His great pain is that he failed, and he did fail.
Now, we've discussed Russia. I'd also like to, because most of our listeners are Americans, I would like to discuss a little bit about the role of the United States and the other Anglo-Saxon nations, Canada, Australia, Great Britain, New Zealand, in the whole picture. And that's another thing that sometimes came out in Windswept House, is that the, let's say, Italian-based cardinals would refer to the Anglo-Saxons. Yes. What role do the Anglo-Saxon nations play in the church and to do with Rome?
Well, it may seem a contradiction to you or to many people. The biggest role the Anglo-Saxon nations are playing and will play as regards the Church of Rome is as follows. The Anglo-Saxons have been the source and the creators of the Lodge, starting with the Scottish Lodge. The Lodge is something in which hides the only enemies of the truth on the face of this earth. And in their upper reaches, 33rd degree and beyond, the carefulest plans for destruction of the Roman Catholic Church as a church, not as an organization, they wanted to go on. Those plans have been laid there. And the Anglo-Saxons are the ones that pursue it. They are the ones that are the seedbed of it all. That's their importance for the Roman Catholic Church. Now, there are some fervent Catholics in England, and there are some fervent Catholics in the United States, and in New Zealand, and in Ireland, and in Australia. But the importance, as regards the Anglo-Saxons and Rome, is this antipathy, this polar opposite. That's how things have lined up. And the big Masonic influence against the Roman Catholic Church, against faith, against the supernatural, against the whole mission of Christ, comes from only from the Masons. But now, I'm not talking about the Shriners, the men you see with the little caps, with the little fezzes, and having celebrations every year, or the Elks. No, that's what I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the real basic brotherhood of Masons who have as a life's aim to eliminate supernatural in Roman Catholicism and use the organization for humanitarian purposes. They have a prophecy to that effect made in the 18th century, and they're strictly following that.
Now, there's another factor, too. During the Cold War, the United States and the Vatican, and also the United States' Anglo-Saxon allies, found themselves on the same side in opposing atheistic communism. Now it seems that the policies of the American government and the Vatican are at odds, because isn't the United States now, especially with some of the most recent bills that have cleared the House of Representatives and the Senate, isn't the United States government pushing population control, which runs diametrically opposed to the Vatican's agenda?
Absolutely. There's a direct clash there between the two of them. And we now are committed to limiting the population of about 15 countries. We've named them. And there's an executive order signed by every the nation every president since Dick Nixon, ordering the spreading of sterilization, abortion, and contraceptive methods for these nations as a security threat to the United States, as dire a threat to us as our nuclear bombs. See, they call now the, it is called in this document, it's a famous document, 200 in SSM, they call it a strategic necessity. In the language of diplomacy, a strategic necessity is something which is necessary for my survival as a nation. And we must have nuclear weapons for the survival of our nation. We must also sterilize, abort, and contracept for the security of the United States, according to the executive order. It's as bad as that. And we contribute in a minimum of $5 billion a year abroad for this. We're not talking about what's done at home. That's a different fund. We contribute at least $5 billion abroad, and we push it. And every organ of government of the United States government is supposed to join it, whether it's the Minister of the Interior or whether it's the Department of Commerce, no matter what it is, they all must contribute to this fight against population control.
Now, is there an underlying spiritual or Luciferian reason why this limit the population agenda is being promoted? Because strictly from a scientific or economic viewpoint, there's no necessity. Because I know of various programs, both in Canada and the United States, that actually pay farmers not to grow wheat because there's so much of a surplus.
It doesn't make sense. What does make sense is the following. First of all, the slaughter of human beings. Do you remember what the Carthaginians used to do outside of Carthage? They had this mound, this hill, and there was a perpetual fire there maintained by the priests of Moloch. And every morning the women would take their newborn babies and burn them. That was Carthage. Well, instead of the devil having that amount of worship by killing innocent babies, we now have, 300 million a year all over the world wide, babies that are killed every day, every year.
Through abortion.
Yeah, and abortifacient contraceptives. Never forget that. Many children are killed in the womb by contraceptives that are abortifacient.
And is this...
The point I'm making to you is this, that it satisfied the devil's desire to kill off human beings without baptism.
So really then, the agenda is to keep souls out of heaven then?
That's away from God's grasp, away from him. He made them and he loved them. And he wants them, but he can't have them because they're going to die without baptism. I think God has his own solution for that problem. That's number one benefit of it. Number two benefit of it is that it also, it means that those against the church are going to have power to limit the church's ambit and reduce its teaching and wipe it out as a supernaturally inclined organization. So it's a double whammy, and it's succeeding. It's succeeding because more Catholics now practice contraception than don't.
And is pressure coming down, let's say, upon the minority of Christian families, let's say, of various denominations who have large families?
Absolutely. Not to have large families. After two children, the pressure is always on them. And we now know that 62% of all two children Catholic families have undergone either vasectomy or fallopian tubes tying up. Effectively, sterilization. Effectively. But it's private. But 62% of them have. So when you see a family of two children only, you can be, I think, about 80% sure that it's deliberate. They've sterilized each other. Or that one of them has been sterilized. So they wouldn't have any more children. Because it's not chic, it's not social, it's not environmental, it's not American, it's not socially beneficial, you're not being mainstream.